Welcome to Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Ken Nash with Mimi Rosenberg. Later on Building Bridges, we'll talk with David Kallick from the Fiscal Policy Institute on the city budget, cutbacks, and taxes. And we'll also have a piece commemorating today's anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. But first,
I'm very pleased to have with us on Building Bridges the coordinator of the Workers' Advice Center. The Workers' Advice Center originated in response to the lack of support for workers who are marginalized and overlooked by Israel's National Labor Federation, the Histadrut. The WAC is open to any worker, although Arabs in particular suffer from lack of union support. And with that, we have with us the coordinator of the WAC, Asaf Adiv, and it's a pleasure to be speaking with you today.
It's a pleasure to speak to you also, and I hope I can bring you some idea of what our situation is and what our work is to confront this very difficult situation here in this country.
Why don't we begin by some specifics about the demographics of the people with whom you work, the benefits, the working conditions, the employment opportunities or lack thereof?
If somebody wants to have a very general idea of what is happening in Israel and Palestine these days, you cannot overlook the importance of the economic situation, of the social catastrophe that basically the Palestinian people face because of the some past 15 years of implementation of a program of privatization and impact of the globalization process in the Middle East. So I would like your listeners and people there in the United States to understand that we're talking about a country, actually Israel controls since 1967 the whole of mandatory Palestine. And in this sense, economically speaking, the Israeli economy and the Palestinian economy is one economy, to very basic sense. So if you talk about Israel, you're talking about an economy that has 2.5 million people in its workforce. If you talk about what is now the Palestinian Authority or areas, Palestinian areas who are under the Palestinian Authority, the number of people in the workforce is about 750,000 people. Inside the Israeli labor force, you have some 300,000 Arab workers and some 300,000 foreign workers, which we'll talk about later about the basic conditions of these workers. But basically, what can be said in the beginning as a just to understand the situation is that you have actually something like 25% to 30% of the workforce which is completely underprivileged second or even third degree workers.
Mimi had mentioned in the introduction that the Palestinian workers in Israel are not in the Israeli Labor Federation. Is that true in all sectors or is it just true in some areas?
It should be clear that the officially speaking Palestinian Arab workers who are citizens of Israel could be, and some of them are, members of the Histadrut. The problem is that the labor market is, historically speaking, is segregated in front of Arab workers. It means that in many basic branches of the Israeli economy, no Arab can go in. And in the last 10 years, as everywhere in the world, the labor market has been undergone a privatization process. It means that many, many branches have just gone private, and in this sense, even those who were members of the Histadrut have become completely transformed into completely unorganized casual workers. Most Arab workers who were even before organized in, let's say, construction or textile or, let's say, marginal parts of the economy have become now unorganized casual workers. So what happened was eventually most Arab workers are not organized because they don't have regular jobs.
How do the conditions in the refugee camps versus people who are citizens of Israel and are Arabs differ? Or are they both in a similar situation where they are discriminated against in the labor market?
I think we should put things, you know, I think for people in America to understand the connection between what we are talking about and what they see in television every day, these horrific pictures and news about the killings and the destruction that is taking place in this part of the world, I think it is important to put in context this struggle. We are talking about a situation where 8 years or 9 years ago, 8.5 years ago, the whole world celebrated the peace of the brave between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Clinton hosted in the White House Arafat and Rabin in 1993 in a very big celebration of peace, and this should have been the beginning of a new era in the Middle East. The Palestinian people actually is a people of refugees. Even people who are not in other countries as refugees, like in Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, where you have like 4 to 5 million Palestinian refugees outside of their homeland, they cannot even go back to visit their homeland, not to speak, to live there and work there. Even people in the West Bank and Gaza, many of them live in refugee camps because they were kicked out of their homes and their villages and their towns back in 48 when the Israeli state was established. It's a people of refugees. So the question of the Palestinians, peace with the Palestinians, should have been discussed, or let's say should have given a solution, hope for the refugees, should have given hope for the workers, for wage earners, for families, for children, for everybody in the Palestinian people at large, including Palestinians who are, who were, and continue to be citizens of Israel, who are 20% of the Israeli population, and as I mentioned before, are second-class citizens in Israel, and were segregated in many, many different aspects of life and work from a possibility to progress and to go forward inside Israel. So the question that is posed is what happened? Why this peace, why this agreement did not work? Why the American message that now where the world is now free of competition, free of confrontation between the two blocks, why America, the only force in the Middle East, could not bring up, could not lead the two peoples towards peace? Of course, it has different, I think it has different aspects to this, response, this question. I don't mean to go to all of them or many of that I think about them, but I think that what has to be discussed is what was the economic and social development since 1993. What happened here since this agreement, since the peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis? Did we go forward or did we go backward? And if we talk about hard facts in terms of employment, social situation, what is clear is that we went backward. And the situation is that this explosion of violence and war again in the Middle East is a direct result of the fact that we went backwards and not went forward.
I guess the question at this point is, why did things start to fall apart in terms of the economy, and especially with regard to the Palestinian people within the borders of Israel after 93?
Well, I think that the question of after 1993, after the Oslo Peace Accords, is basically a question that deals with the West Bank and Gaza. And I think we can go further on the question that WAC, the Workers' Advice Center, is more specifically deal with the situation inside Israel. Secondly, but first of all, let's see what happened in the West Bank and Gaza. And what I'm talking about is I have in front of me an article that was published yesterday by one of the most important influential economic commentator in Israeli press, Seva Plotker from the Yediot Ahronot, the biggest newspaper in Israel, and his article tries to explain that actually since Oslo, the situation has become so good to the Palestinians that the extremists in the Palestinian side could not handle this. Actually, the population was so satisfied from the situation that the extremists wanted to cut this process, and this is why they initiated the Intifada and just destroyed everything. The problem with this picture is that it doesn't try to go to the point where the Intifada started a year and a half ago. The numbers that it brings doesn't bring the comparison between what happened in Israel and what happened in the West Bank and Gaza. It means that what we had after Oslo is going back in the level of development, even if you talk about the number of hospital beds, even if you talk about the number of schools, if you talk about the level of unemployment, if you talk about the poverty situation, actually the situation before Oslo was better than after Oslo. So people felt completely frustrated from the fact that you promised us peace and prosperity, and actually we live worse than what we had under direct occupation. The problem was not only the suffering and the poverty and the unemployment and the neglect. It was also the big gap between what was promised and what was there.
Asaf, if I may, how does globalization, which you made reference to earlier, fit into this? When we had spoken previously, we had looked at the issue of U.S. policies, globalization, and its impact on the workforce, and really the demobilization of whole industries, or the removal of industries, as well as individual opportunities for people to gain work.
The truth is that if we go to more specifically to what we deal with as an association of workers, is that what you see, especially in the last 10 years in Israel, is a very fast acceptance and implementation of the rules of the global economy. What it meant in Israel was that everything that has to do with local economy, in terms of what is called the old economy, actually was put into a fierce competition of the world market. Taxes and any kind of subsidies for the local production were removed. And of course, in the situation of the global market, it was impossible for local industry to compete with cheap labor, even in very close Arab countries like Jordan, Egypt, or China and other countries in Asia. So what happened was that a whole branch number of branches of the industry were just cut into half or even less than half. Like textiles, like shoes, like, for example, you had a factory that produced Levi's jeans in Israel for 30 years. It has closed and they are importing them now. It's cheaper to produce them in Central America and to bring them here because Israel and America has a free trade agreement. For example, you had hundreds of local textile shops in the Arab villages. They moved production lines to Jordan, to Romania, to Sri Lanka. They are importing now the products. For example, Israel was proud to have its own steel company owned by the Histadrut, public company. It was closed and now they import it from Turkey. And other similar examples of this old economy was just closed. Israel actually implemented the rules of global economy without any qualification, without any limitations. It was so enthusiastic about it because actually for many years, like 10 years in the whole 1990s, Israel was compensated by the fact that it was very, very strong in the high-tech technology sector. So the overall picture of the Israeli economy was very nice. Everything was going forward, basically. Exports, the level of development, the growth rate was so high, and all the indicators showed that Israel is going forward. Then you had in 2000 big collapse of the high-tech technology sector overall in the world, and the decline of the Nasdaq stock exchange. And Israeli economy actually lost its the locomotive that actually pushed it forward was suddenly cut into less than half. So you don't have the old sectors, because they are completely destroyed by the competition of the world market. And you don't have the new compensation for it, because the high-tech technology sector is very much damaged. And then you had the Intifada and the war that started all over the world after the attacks in New York. So you have a situation where the economy just stopped and was brought almost to a halt.
Within this context, Asaf, How do you see, as an organization, proceeding? What can the Workers Advice Center actually accomplish?
Well, the situation that we face very concretely is that we see this situation. We are talking about percentage of unemployment which are very high. As I mentioned before, Arab workers were, even before that, when Israel was booming and the economy was going forward, the Arabs, the Palestinians were always marginalized. What you have, because of this development in Israel, actually what you have is also parts of the Jewish working class being marginalized, because what was before a state for the Jewish people has become now a state for the Jewish rich. And what is important in Israel, as in everywhere in the world, is the profit and nothing else. And this changes many, many things. So what we are trying to do is to, because the Israeli economy is in a situation where it cannot go forward with this unlimited integration into the globalized world, and it starts to stop this process. Actually, they have these contradictions inside the Israeli ruling circles or economic circles. What should they do? And they don't know what to do. For one example of this is the fact that they decided to re-employ Arab workers in construction in order to reduce the unemployment situation, which is very, very high, especially in the Arab localities. So we have an opportunity now, and this is what the Workers' Advice Center has started to do several months ago, is to organize Arab workers who used to work in construction in order to take over again the jobs that were just completely closed in front of the Arab workers 10 years ago. So what we are organizing now, people who used for 10 years to be casual workers, to be unemployed, to be completely refused out of the organized job market, and to organize groups of workers who would force their way back to the workforce.
So how is that going? I know that there is some action and some case that's pending before the Israeli court with regard to the question of those particular jobs. So if you could update on that.
First of all, we are trying to update in our website, and if I can present it to people who want to follow it more on and on all the time. So you can see it in www.workersadvicecenter.org. This is our website. So you just advicecenter.org. And also there is a magazine called Challenge, which follows usually our work and carries all the time stories about our work, which is www.hanitzotz.com/challenge, challenge, okay. And it ran this kind of report on this, and it is in our website. What happened was that we presented to the contractors in Israel, as a Workers' Advice Center, we presented them a challenge. We have a list of workers in different professionals in the construction area. Why don't you employ them? You say that you want to employ local Arab citizens in your companies, but nobody wants. Actually, they are maneuvering all the time. They go to the employment centers and they ask for workers, and then they make these interviews to fail, and then they go back to the court and the government and say, well, we tried and it didn't work. Nobody wants to work. Local workers don't want to work. We have to bring in these kind of groups of foreign workers which are coming under slave conditions without any rights. So we presented the challenges. We said we are ready to provide people, lists of people, and people are going back into the companies. We have now a second group just went this week, and today we had a meeting with the workers, went into the biggest construction company in Israel, Sorel Bonet, and people are going in organized. It means they're not going individually. They're not going in just as an individual worker who might be kicked out the next day without nobody seeing it. They're going inside organized as a group of organized people who, with the situation where the Workers' Advice Center, as an independent association that follows up on this, is actually representing them in front of the company.
Asaf, as we wind up, Vice President Cheney is in the Middle East, and there are overtures that have made around a presumed peace plan by Anthony Zinni. What is the response of the Workers Advice Center on these overtures or on these realities?
We are very, very, very pessimistic about the American policy. We are very, very, we see it as something that doesn't lead nowhere, doesn't lead to any positive solution. Actually, the contradiction or the absurd situation is that if Cheney was successful in his trip, and actually if they manage up to next Wednesday, there is an Arab League summit in Beirut. So if they manage to get any kind of ceasefire in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict by chance, which I doubt, this would only mean that we are getting closer to a bigger war on Iraq. It means it's not even a presumption or a picture or an illusion of peace as it was 8 years ago. And I said what I mentioned before, Oslo. I said that Oslo was actually a haven for Israel and a hell for the Arabs and the Palestinians, but at least it had a cover of peace for everybody in the Middle East. Now we're not talking anymore on peace for everybody in the Middle East. We're talking about a maximum, we're talking about a short-term ceasefire in the Israeli-Palestinian war in order to get a bigger war in Iraq, when actually, the Americans did not even finish, and they don't know how to finish, because they didn't know actually why they started the war in Afghanistan. So I think we are in a very messy situation. The Bush administration has no solution, not to the Israelis, not to the Palestinians, not to anybody, I think, in the world.
Well, Asaf Adib, we've barely skimmed the surface of understanding the labor situation in Israel, in Palestine, in the West Bank, in Gaza, in the camps. I hope we can return and visit you more frequently so we can get a much better understanding of what our sisters and brothers are faced with in that area of the world. And I have been speaking with Asaf Adib, who is the National Coordinator of the Workers' Advice Center. And we'd like to thank you very much for speaking with us.
Okay, I thank you for this opportunity to speak to American people, American workers. And I hope can develop this kind of a discussion. And I want to conclude by saying that we are not seeing our situation as something that is separate from the situation in America and everywhere in the world, and we are actually seeking forward or looking forward to open this kind of a discussion with people who are in a similar way concerned and are not satisfied with the way things are going, and especially in the labor movement, people who want to change the situation, who want to present a challenge to the current things, how things are going, and to build a new leadership that would be more actually more keen to what is happening in the world, international in its outlook, and move forward to present a new labor movement all over the world.
And this is Building Bridges, your community and labor report over WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial. 91 years ago today, on March 25th, 1911, there was a disastrous sweatshop fire in New York City, the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. So that we never forget, and that this memory is used to combat today's sweatshops both here and abroad, we created this piece.
This is a Building Bridges, your community and labor report special to commemorate Women's History Month. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
Ken and I are standing on the corner of Green Street and Washington Place at what is now a New York University building. This is the site of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, in which on March 25, 1911, 146 sweatshop workers, mostly young immigrant women, lost their lives. Ken, there's only a small plaque on the side of the building to commemorate this tragedy, which 91 years ago awakened the nation to the need for protective legislation and unions to eradicate sweatshops.
Mimi, on similar buildings all over the city, there is no way to know that on the inside there are sweatshops in which today's immigrants toil under conditions not very different from the Triangle workers. And I wonder, is there any lasting commemoration at the site of the fire in the Hamlet, North Carolina poultry processing plant, which in 1991, 25 workers died, or on the site of the Chowdhury knitwear factory in Bangladesh, where on November 25, 2000, 51 workers died?
A few years ago, a young woman of African descent, Sophia Henderson Holmes, stood at this same intersection, Ken, that you and I are at now, and pondered the plight of the Triangle workers. Sophia is gone now. She died of cancer. But she left this poem about the Triangle tragedy to help us remember and to fight on. She talks first about the conditions of the workers at the Triangle factory.
Shirtwaist factory room, 1911. Crowded, hard, fast, too fast. Closed windows, locked doors. Smell of piss, of sweat, of wishes being cut to bits. Needle stabs, electric shocks, miscarriages over silk. Fading paisley, fading magenta. Falling in love will get you fired. Forever old, never fast enough. Buying flowers is wasteful. So hurry, hurry, grind your teeth and soul. $6 a week sent to grandfather. $4 a week sent to Aunt Ruth. Sleep over the machine and you're done for way before you open your eyes, ma'am, madam, miss, Mrs. Mother, girlie. Hundreds of flowering green spring girls in rows, waiting with needles in hands for spring to show. The strike the year before. And they shouted, open the doors, unwire the windows, more air, more stairs, more quiet time, more fire escapes, and to the ground, damn you, and more toilets, more time to be sick, more time to be well, and remove the fear, and slow it down, for God's sake, slow it all down. It's spring, they shouted. Hundreds of flowering girls shouted, for spring to hurry, hurry, and enter their world. And Triangle won a half day, but the doors remained locked, windows remained wired, no extra air, no extra quiet time or sick time. The fear stayed, nothing slowed, and God watched. Hundreds of flowering girls twirl, hundreds of flowering girls willow and twirl.
Mimi, 2 years ago in Bangladesh, 51 sweatshop workers, 10 of whom were children, lost their lives trying to escape from a burning garment factory. Like the workers at Triangle and Hamlet, these workers were trapped inside by a locked gate, and their deaths have also given fuel to the movement to abolish sweatshops, this time worldwide. We talked with Barbara Briggs from the National Labor Committee, which fights for sweatshops on the globe.
On March 25, 1911, 146 women died in the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. Because the factory doors were closed to prevent them from leaving during the forced overtime, they jumped to their deaths, or they were trapped inside, asphyxiated, and burned to death. Something that a lot of people don't know is that 400,000 people marched during the main funeral procession to express their grief and their anger, and what they said was, "Never again." That was really the beginning of our modern U.S. labor law. It was the beginning of the abolition of child labor and the factory safety and health regulations that we have now. But almost 90 years later, on November 25th in the year 2000, in a five-story factory in Bangladesh called Chowdhury Knitwear, there was another fire. Again, the women and girls were working forced overtime. These women worked 12 to 14-hour days, 7 days a week. They normally worked from 7 o'clock in the morning until 7 o'clock at night. It was about 6:30 at night. The fire broke out. It started to get smoky, but they calmly proceeded down the stairs until they reached the locked gate. Then they started to push. Then the fire burst through the walls. It went dark. The electricity went out. It was filled with smoke. The women panicked. Most of them were crushed to death. Many of them were asphyxiated. And again, many of them jumped. And some of them were impaled on the fence down below. 54 women and girls were killed. 10 of them were children between the ages of 10 and 14. And we ask ourselves, where is the protest? In this, the country that buys the garments that these women and girls made, who will mourn for them and who will protest and who is going to say never again? We have the beginnings of an anti-sweatshop movement in this country, and it's grown in a really exciting way. We see students on over 300 university campuses that are beginning to demand that their university garments be made under conditions that protect fundamental human and workers' rights in the factories, no matter where they are in the world. We see church parishes, union locals, and everyday people saying, I don't want to buy clothing or other products that are made in sweatshops or made by child labor. The women in Bangladesh have actually communicated with us directly and asked us for help. They're saying, don't take our jobs away. We need these jobs. Our country needs investment. Please ask the U.S. companies to assure that our bosses are giving us safe factory conditions and that we get one day off a week to rest and to take care of our families and our households. So it seems to us that together, we in the country that is buying the products that these women make are in a very special position to demand of our U.S. corporations, don't cut and run, stay, improve conditions, pay a living wage, assure that there's not another Triangle Shirtwaist fire, not another Chowdhury Knitwear fire to kill the very workers who are making the products that we buy. The best thing that we can do to honor the young women and remember the young women who died in the Triangle Shirtwaist fire is to dedicate ourselves to helping their sisters here in Bangladesh, in China, in El Salvador. Insist that our U.S. corporations, Walmarts, the Kmarts, all the U.S. companies that make the products that we buy, respect workers' rights wherever they're producing the products. We have to start to press for enforceable worker rights protections. We can do this here in the United States, and it's exciting. It's something that's on the move and growing. We hope that many, many people will be joining us in the coming year.
Sophia Henderson Holmes' poem about the Triangle Fire might as well be speaking about Chowdhury, might as well be speaking about Hamlet and the disasters, the fires, and the death of so many.
March 25th, smoke, smoke, stopping the machines. Run to wired windows, run to locked doors, run to the one and only fire escape. Everyone, run to the air. Hundreds of flowering girls, fire. Catching bouquets of girls in a corner, tall, long-stemmed lilies on fire in a corner, from bloom to ashes in a corner, smell them in the rain, hundreds of tulip girls. On a window ledge, pliés for life, on a window ledge, lovely ribboned young ladies on their tiptoes, twirling, twirling, an arabesque for life, hundreds of flowering girls, smell them in the rain, hundreds of jasmine girls. The ladders were too short. The hoses were too short. The men holding the nets were not gods, only men, who never caught or trained to catch falling bodies or falling stars or hundreds of flowering girls, hundreds of carnation bud girls. And the girls were not angels, but girls jumping, not goddesses flying or hovering. They smashed. They broke into large pieces. Smell them in the rain. And the sidewalks opened in shame to meet the flowering girls. The sidewalks opened in such horrible shame to cradle the remains of violets, and the gutters bled for hours, choking on bones, shoes, buttons, ribbons, holy sewing needles. The gutters bled for hours, all the colors of spring, the cool magenta of delicate spring.
You've been listening to poet Sophia Henderson Holmes, an activist Barbara Briggs reflect on the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire and other sweatshop tragedies in order to help us remember so we can act to abolish sweated labor here and around the globe. This has been a Building Bridges, your community and labor report special for Women's History Month.
And you're listening to WBAI Radio 99.5 on your FM dial, radio for social change. Every decade or so, it seems, New York City endures another fiscal crisis in which severe cutbacks of services seem to be the only alternative. But must we grin and bear it? Let's see, or rather hear.
And with us to discuss the city budget is David Disregard-Kallick, who is a senior fellow at the Fiscal Policy Institute in New York City. David, before we start to talk about what else can be done, what else is possible, why don't you lay out, perhaps with a short critique, the policies of the Bloomberg administration to close what they say is a $4.7 billion budget deficit in the next fiscal year?
I would say we have no reason to think that the $4.7 billion budget gap is not the right number. So we think that's more or less on target. The Bloomberg administration has essentially said that they are going to borrow a significant amount of money in order to close part of the budget gap. They're going to think about tolls on the East River bridges in order to increase revenues and maybe also to regulate traffic. And they're going to talk about a cigarette tax. Other than that, they're going to essentially take all of the very significant gap out of current programs. So there'll be cuts across the boards in services, with some more significant than others, but education, schools is included in the cuts, fire and police are included in the cuts. There's basically nothing where he said that, you know, that there is not room to or necessity to cut out of services rather than raising taxes in other ways.
I'm convinced that Mayor Bloomberg did this to prevent me from going from Brooklyn to Manhattan ever again.
That was on my advice.
Aside from that, Charles Barron, a newly elected member of the council from the East New York District of Brooklyn, has been raging against the budget and, in effect, insisting that there are better ways to deal with the budget deficit. What is your position? Are there better ways?
Well, I think he's right. I think that this is not the time to be cutting services. And, you know, I think the idea that I was personally quite outraged to see Bloomberg saying that, you know, that the city school system could just absorb a 3% cut without any kind of problems, even though the number of students are, you know, large and increasing, even though they've been absorbing all kinds of cuts over many, many years. I don't know, in our son's school, we bring in paper and pencils for the kids. It's just outrageous. I mean, you know, it just seems to me like maybe it's true that in the private sector where he comes from, that the idea that a 3% cut is something you could just absorb is possible. But after, you know, I don't know if anybody who's been in a government office anytime recently will know that the Xerox machines are old. There's, you know, nothing is really is able to be cut easily.
But David, don't we have to belt tighten? We have no other option. These are rough times. Recession, post 9/11.
Well, the obvious alternative is to raise revenues in some way, and you know, nobody likes to talk about raising taxes, but I think that when given the option, better for the city.
Comment just briefly. I mean, whenever anybody brings up the idea of raising taxes to Bloomberg, all he basically says is, no, we can't do that. That's counterproductive. Is that enough?
I think that can't be, that's not enough of an answer. I think that there's a serious debate to be had always about, you know, nobody likes to raise taxes. If we could have all the, you know, high quality services that we'd like without having to pay for them, I'm sure everybody would be in favor of that. So I think, you know, the question right now as we think about, you know, rebuilding after the terrible catastrophe of the World Trade Center and, you know, and the recession that we're, you know, that the sea is still in, you know, how do we best think about moving forward? It seems to me like people talk sometimes about the idea that, you know, if you raise taxes, you start to have people leaving the city. And it just seems obvious to me that the reason people leave the city, you know, is when they can't send their kids to public schools, when they, you know, feel like the streets are dirty, when they feel like it's not safe. And this is just very much the wrong time to be starting to cut back on services, as there's a great deal of nervousness in the city, as we need to be increasing security, as we need to be increasing efficiencies. I don't see how we can do it.
Last month, we lost 14,000 jobs. It's estimated that we've lost at least 100,000 jobs relative to somewhat before September 11th, but since. So what is the, aside from raising taxes, what is necessary to begin to bring the job base back and create the revenues and the spending in New York City?
First of all, we need to invest in the infrastructure that makes the city such an attractive place to begin with. And that's probably, first of all, the transportation infrastructure. You know, what makes it an appealing place to do business in large part is the workforce that the companies can attract here, where they can draw from the 15 million people in the area, and they can bring them into a very concentrated place. So I think that's probably our first and most important thing to do is to figure out how we, as quickly and as effectively as possible, rebuild the transportation infrastructure so it serves all of the city neighborhoods and so it serves the suburbs well. And then I think we ought to have, I mean, I think the point that you're raising is a good one. A lot of people have lost their jobs. At the same time, we're hitting welfare time limits, right? So a lot of people are being forced off of welfare without a prospect of employment anywhere. And I think we need to be thinking about how do we do job creation.
The federal government Bush just promised another $10 billion to New York City. Is any of this going for the kinds of things you're talking about?
Well, it's still very much up in the air. I think that, you know, we're certainly arguing that it should be. It's been somewhat constricted. There's a great danger that the money will be used primarily for compensating businesses for lost business and for tax incentives to companies to try to lure them here or to try to keep them here. My feeling is that tax incentives are really not the reason people locate here. The thing that makes New York attractive is all of the wonderful things about the city. It's an expensive place compared to others. You know, if people were looking for the cheapest real estate possible, they'd be locating in Mississippi or Tennessee or somewhere else. And they're looking for the advantages that the city has to bring. And I think what we should be doing is trying to, you know, concentrate on improving the quality of those things rather than trying to, you know, lure them with the prospect that maybe they won't pay taxes for a few years.
I just get the image of pigs at the trough. I mean, I don't see a lot of this stuff actually keeping anybody in the city at all. It just seems to me as if companies will say, oh, we'll leave and they get paid off, but there's no net addition.
I mean, I was just outraged yesterday or the day before, Dan Bachtroff, the mayor's deputy mayor on these issues, talking about how they can't, you know, they're giving out these tax incentives now, or actually they're giving out cash right now to companies located downtown. And the reporter raised the question, what happens if a lot of these companies were companies that weren't even threatening to leave? And he said, what, don't we at least want to ask whether they're threatening to leave the city or not? He said, oh, well, they just lie anyway. You know, this is the mayor's person on this. They just lie about it anyway, so we really can't ask them. But we'll give them the money just the same because, you know, we feel like they somehow deserve it. I appreciate the difficulties of doing business downtown right now, but that's not a strategy for addressing the point that Mimi's talking about of how are you going to really think about creating jobs.
There is a lot of discussion about the style differential between Giuliani and Bloomberg, but is there a substantive approach to economic development that is in any way fundamentally different than the Giuliani administration?
I would say that the Giuliani administration seemed to focus primarily on this idea of handing away tax incentives to companies, very frequently on an individual company basis, or, you know, these stadiums that he was somewhat obsessed with. I think the Bloomberg administration, I would say, you know, I think it's a little early to say. I feel somewhat hopeful. I know that Bloomberg himself was very critical of this kind of tax subsidy, even though his company, I don't know if you remember, but he was in the news, his company had received $17, $18 million tax incentive to stay in the city, and he gave it back. And when he was elected and said, you know, look, this isn't really the right kind of approach, and he said that, he said something like that any company that makes its location decisions based on tax credits is not going to be in business very long. that's hopeful. On the other hand, you know, having them going around handing out money downtown to businesses for no better reason than that they're there, my feeling is that we need to concentrate sectorally. You know, we need to be thinking much more about what are the sectors where there's going to be, you know, where there could be growth, what are the sectors where we'd like to see growth, because, you know, I would say it ought to be those sectors where, you know, they have good middle wage, middle-income jobs, and how could you do something that would target that sector? You know, can we provide technical assistance? Can we provide loan programs? Can we provide, you know, can we think about the real estate and zoning issues? And I think that there are a lot of ways that we could start to develop programs. I mean, I would be very much in favor also of some publicly subsidized jobs. I think that we're asking people, I think that it will pay for itself in the end. It's better for the city. It's better for everybody if people are working. And, you know, I think it's very hard to be asking people on welfare, for example, to enter into a job market when there just aren't jobs.
Even though the Dinkins administration did raise the city income tax for a number of years to pay for additional police, talk about taxes for a long time seemed to be taboo. So let's talk about taxes. Which ones do you think might be raised?
I think that whenever you're raising taxes, the best way to do it is to do it in a progressive way so that, you know, the people who can most afford to bear the burden are the ones who pay the most. You know, so I think that the tax that fits that bill for the city would be the city income tax. I think the city is one of the few in the state that has an income tax, and that's the right vehicle to look to. And I would propose that we raise the rate by 1% on people making over $150,000, and, you know, maybe 2% on people making over $250,000.
How much money would that bring in?
That would bring in, you know, the calculations are different, but that would bring in something on the order of $600, $700 million.
You mentioned welfare a moment ago. One of the peculiarities to my way of thinking as we watch some 24,000 people reach time limits and drop through the enormous holes in the what was previously at least some kind of a safety net is that there will not be taking advantage of the federal monies that could come in to sustain people with food stamps and so on. I mean, how do you understand the Bloomberg administration being so peculiar, so cavalier perhaps, in failing to take advantage of additional monies that may be there to sustain the poorest of the poor in New York, who, of course, I should point out as somebody who works with this fairly constantly, when poor people are able to pay their rent pursuant to a grant from public assistance, et cetera, that certainly helps enormous numbers of rather lower income landlords in the city. So it would seem to be a total benefit.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's certainly true, and I think, you know, the right place to address the problem is, first of all, at the federal level, and I think the federal government should be responsible because of the nature of the attack on the city, and I should say that a significant part, I think most people know this by now, but a significant part of the budget deficit or the budget gap was structural. It was probably, you know, it really does not have to do with September 11th, and in fact, about $3 billion has to do with past tax cuts that the city has implemented and the state has implemented. But the rest of it is because of September 11th, and that seems to me like, you know, very appropriate for the federal government to make up for that. The federal government is coming through with some other kinds of money, but it's not coming up with anything to the city for its lost tax revenues. So the city is forced into the position of either cutting services or raising taxes, both of which are the wrong thing to do in a recession. The federal government can, you know, can go into deficit if need be in order to cover expenses, but the city can't do that. And so I think it's definitely the right place to be focusing at the federal level. I mean, I hate to rule out any possibilities, but the problem is that the Bush administration has not been terribly responsive about this.
Well, Bush aside, you had mentioned, of course, the income tax, but it has to go through the state legislature.
Right.
And as would the commuter tax, which just about everybody except Bloomberg is in favor of restoring.
Sure.
People have mentioned the property tax. Do you think that's a viable alternative? That wouldn't have to go through the state legislature.
An income tax can be proposed by the city, and a state legislature would have to approve it. And the mayor, of course, would very likely, in order to make that politically viable, would probably have to get behind it, which we hope that he may possibly begin to see the light and do. I mean, I think that if we're backed absolutely into a corner and there are no other choices except to either have a property tax or service cuts. I think property tax is better than service cuts. The problem with a property tax is that it's a regressive tax. It's very, you know, the property tax system in New York is quite convoluted, and the way that it's administered and who pays what, and it's not a very fair tax. But it does generate a significant portion of revenues, and, you know, if there are no other alternatives except for service cuts, I think, you know, that would be. But I would first of all push as hard as we can. You know, I think that the right level of priorities would be you start at the federal government, which is the best place to solve most of these issues. The state government would be the second level, and a state income tax increase would actually be, you know, would have the advantage of being essentially like a commuter tax. People from out of state do actually pay the state income tax; they just don't pay the city income tax. So people who live in New Jersey and Connecticut, if you raise the top rate on the state income tax, would be paying, would be contributing to that. And the problem, again, is it going to happen or not? I mean, I think that we're trying to work on as many fronts as we can. It would be, if we had our preference, I think that's where we would solve most of the problem. But, I mean, as you say, I think that if there's nothing else to do, property taxes are the one significant thing that the city can do on its own without any cooperation from any other level of government.
How do you evaluate the response of Giffith Miller, who is the new leader of the council, in response to the Bloomberg budget?
He's been saying, you mean, that everything, that he wants to put revenues on the table. Is this what you mean?
Yes.
It's certainly a step in the right direction. I mean, I think he could be a little bit more proactive about what the proposal would be, but hopefully he'll come around to that. I think it's certainly right to say that, I mean, Bloomberg, in a very, I think you called it, cavalier kind of way, essentially pushed off the table any discussion of revenues, of tax increases, and didn't give very substantial reasoning for why, and, you know, hoped, I guess, that there wouldn't be any kind of public discussion about it. So I think, you know, Giffith Miller is right to say, no, we're not going to just push it off the table. The city council has to go along with this and has a role in the budget also, hopefully a more substantial role than the past city council did, and because it's so new, because there's so many new members, I think there's some hope that they will be much more proactive about these things. So I think it's positive for him to say, let's consider it. I wouldn't mind if he were a little bit more bold about what exactly he thinks is the right solution.
Well, I think that's something that we'll be seeing in the coming weeks and months as the budget debate heats up. Mimi, was there something else you wanted to get saying?
Well, I'm just hoping I don't have to lead a movement to have Brooklyn secede.
Well, you know what happened the last time with Staten Island.
It's interesting to me that Bloomberg is willing to broach the subject of East River tolls. I mean, I think it's actually a good idea, but I think partly as a revenue question, but also
that's
actually
a very sensitive thing you've just
I know, it's like everybody in Manhattan thinks it's a good idea, and everybody in Brooklyn and Queens probably thinks it's an awful idea.
Well, I'll tell you, the cab drivers that I had recently were enormously distressed over the notion of the increase the institutionalization of a toll, which would hurt an already extraordinarily depressed industry because it comes out of their tips.
Talking in terms of traffic policy, somebody should be pointing out that cabs should be exempt from this because that would basically lower the traffic going into Manhattan. So I think if there is a tax of that sort, I think people should be bringing up certain exemptions, and cabs should be one of them.
I think that's very plausible. I think that there also should be real public transportation options. I mean, I would be actually interested in as much as possible linking that to how do you create better service to the parts of Brooklyn that don't really have very good links into, you know, public transportation, links into Manhattan.
Well, David, I'd like to thank you very much for speaking with us, and I hope we can have you back very soon, as Ken said, as the debates heat up around this most important topic. I guess lastly, though, I'm still interested. People seem to have a hard time, which is understandable the way the mass media has covered things, deciphering, even though you've covered a little bit, the difference of the hardship created pursuant to the catastrophic events around 9/11 versus the recession in general. Is this something that can New York really rebound from the implications of 9-1-1? How much of that really is playing a role in the economic problems that are faced in the city?
Well, I think, I mean, it's a good point, and I think that it's especially the further the further in time we get away from September, the more things may blend together in some ways. But I think that it's important to be clear that the recession was not caused by 9-1-1. I think September 11th gave a push downhill to an economy that was already headed down, and this is a very mainstream position at this point. Alan Greenspan has, you know, said that the recession began last spring, not last fall. And we had, you know, it was sort of in the works. We had this bubble economy for many years. I think that, you know, Fiscal Policy Institute did a real survey, a very careful survey of what were the effects of on jobs of 9/11, and, you know, and found that 60% of the jobs were low wage jobs. The kinds of industries that were affected were, you know, as you say, taxi cabs, hotel, airport, restaurants, garment manufacturers in Chinatown who couldn't get products in and out. I think that there was a very direct tie in each of those to, you know, to. I mean, we would not have been seeing those industries affected in that way if it hadn't been for 9/11, and I think that's pretty clear. And even though you may not be able to draw an absolutely hard and fast line, I think that, broadly speaking, those industries were not going to be suffering in the same disproportionate way in the recession that was already underway. And I think similarly with the city budget, you can certainly, if you, to the extent that there were aid from the state or the federal government that was tied to 9-1-1 events, you know, that was specifically supposed to be compensating for 9-1-1 events, you'd have to draw some criteria to say, you know, what's the different, you know, what are the things that you're saying are a result of that or not. But I think it's not very difficult to do. You can make very good estimates ahead of time, and we've been proposing also that we would be happy to see the city or state have an accounting afterwards also of, you know, okay, what exactly was or wasn't a result of this.
And a lot of that's on your website, right? So why don't you give the address?
www.fiscalpolicy.org, and that's right. We have a number of reports on 9-1. We've been very involved in trying to estimate what's been the effect of 9-1-1 in particular.
Simon, we've been talking with David Desigard-Kallick, who is a senior fellow with the Fiscal Policy Institute. And as I said, this is a subject that we will revisit as the budget debates really start up, probably next week, actually, when a lot of the city council hearings will start. Thanks so much.
Sure, thank you.
David, thank you very much, and do have a good weekend.
And for Building Bridges, your Community and Labor Report, this is Ken Nash in solidarity. Tune in next week, 2 p.m., WBAI 99.5 FM.